The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for a blind or print-impaired listening audience. March 19th of 2026, and this is the Independent John Federson Reading Indie Week for you. All right, I'm recording this on March the 19th. However, the first broadcast actually will be Friday the 20th, and then it will be a podcast, as all of these Indie Week are. First article, petitions seek weak Democratic Party chair's removal over the primary endorsements. Tensions within the Wake County Democratic Party, CDP, over its chair's unusual endorsement of a congressional primary candidate are coming to a head this week in the form of two separate complaints to the North Carolina Democratic Party, the NCDP, calling for his removal. Back in December, Wake Chair Wesley Knott personally endorsed Nita Alam over the incumbent Valerie Fouché in that primary for the 4th Congressional District, a race that illustrated the split between the more establishment and populist wings of the Democratic Party. Speaking with Indy that month, Knott said Fouché exemplifies, quote, a risk-averse and carefully calculated brand of Democratic politics that has failed to inspire voters. He said Alam, quote, has better ideas and would help build a progressive movement that is needed within the Democratic Party, unquote. Knott subsequently appeared in a campaign advertisement for Alam that was critical of Fouché, spoke in support of Alam at a rally headlined by Bernie Sanders, posted about Alam on his personal social media, and authored an op-ed in the Duke Chronicle that praised Alam and suggested Fouché is corrupt. Knott was identified as the local party chair at the rally, in the op-ed, and on his social media account. In wading into the race, Knott deviated from the tradition of party chairs staying neutral in partisan primaries. The county party itself did not endorse in the race. Alam lost to Fouché by a slim margin earlier this month, but that result hasn't quelled the discord that endorsement stirred within the Wake County Democrats. On Monday, John Verdejo, who represents North Carolina on the Democratic National Committee, submitted a petition to the NCDP calling for Knott's removal as the WCDP chair. The Indy obtained a copy of the petition, which argues Knott abused his visibility and authority as chair to unfairly elevate one primary candidate over another. The petition alleges that Knott acted, quote, in a manner inconsistent with neutrality, fairness, and the party's best interests. Several elected leaders in Wake County, including county commissioners, school board members, and city council members, offered to sign on to the petition, according to a source familiar with it. The WCDP's policy is not to endorse in a contested partisan primary, but to throw its support behind the Democratic nominee in the general election. Though not endorsed Alam personally, and not on the party's behalf, the petitioners claim that line is too blurry, since he is the party's face and voice in Wake County. The petition reads, when the county chair publicly intervenes in a contested primary, the injury is not merely a matter of political disagreement. It diminishes confidence in party governance, weakens trust in internal fairness, and signals that formal party authority may be used selectively rather than impartially. Knott pushed back against the petition's characterization in an interview with Indy on Wednesday. He stands by his endorsement of Alam and said it didn't undermine the party. It was an attempt to move it forward. He said, I sleep well at night knowing that I did what was right by my values and beliefs. He granted some people have fair criticisms of the specific ways he promoted Alam's campaign, but he thinks it started a worthwhile conversation about the direction the party is moving. And he said, to be honest, I welcome the opportunity to have those discussions. Knott is calling for a vote of confidence in his leadership at this weekend's WCDP convention. If the vote succeeds, he said he'll turn his attention to the competitive U.S. Senate, judicial, and state legislative races coming up in November. If it fails, he said he will facilitate the election of a new chair and resign. Knott's endorsement of Alam made him an outlier among Wake's Democratic leaders. Most of the delegation to the state legislature, several county commissioners and several school board members, and a handful of mayors and town council members endorsed Fouché. By contrast, only one state representative from Wake and one Apex town council member endorsed Alam, though she did earn other endorsements, including from Bernie Sanders and several national advocacy groups. A second petition for Knott's removal, submitted to NCDP yesterday, which the Indy also obtained, makes some of the same arguments as the first and also claims that Knott used WCDP resources, namely the WCDP email list and his own time as a paid employee of the WCDP, to campaign. The second petition reads, due to the time spent on supporting Alam's campaign, precinct chairs felt they did not get the support for the primary election as a whole that they needed. Candidates and elected officials who did not support Alam have expressed significant concern that they will not be able to count on WCDP support in retaliation, or perhaps Chair Knott will have another candidate he doubles down on and won't give proper attention to preparing for general get-out-the-vote work. Knott said he is a, quote, human being with agency, who spends more than 40 hours per week on his chair job and supported Alam in his personal time, saying, I don't think there is anyone that is involved in any meaningful level in this organization that would question the time and dedication I put into building this party. I appreciate there are some people don't like the way I'm using my influence, but there's nothing in our governing documents that prohibits me from doing anything that I've done. Signatories to that second petition include Wake County School Board member Jennifer Job, Holly Springs Town Commissioner Annie Dries, and former WCDP First Vice Chair Camille Cower. The second petition also blames Knott for omissions in the WCDP's primary voter guide, which did not list several registered Democrats running for U.S. Senate, Wake County Commission, and Raleigh City Council seats, including, as petitioners pointed out, several black candidates. Knott said candidates who did not have a campaign finance committee, two forms of social media, and a website were left off the guide, saying, we did not consider any specific candidate or type of candidate when we made that administrative decision. Cower, one of the signatories to that second petition, resigned from her volunteer leadership position in the WCDP in late February, telling the Indy she was offended by Alam's use of a racial slur in a 2014 tweet that resurfaced in February, and disappointed by Knott's public criticism of Fouché, a progressive Democrat with decades of experience in public service. In a Facebook post announcing her resignation that has since been removed, Cower wrote, quote, witnessing coordinated efforts to undermine and take down a black woman official, I am no longer having the hope or strength to pretend this aligns with the ideals I once fought for. Knott was elected chair in April of 2025 after previously serving as deputy organizing director and executive director. A progressive millennial from rural Mississippi, he vowed to infuse the county party with fresh energy and ramp up door knocking and voter engagement ahead of that year's municipal elections. Speaking with the Indy soon after starting his new job, Knott confidently declared Democrats would sweep elections in Wake County in 2025. He asserted, we have 34 municipal elections this fall, and I plan to win all of them. He came very close. Democrats won all but one Wake County election that November. Fuquay-Varina and Holly Springs, the two reddest towns in the county, ousted two incumbent Republican mayors in favor of Democratic challengers, Kerry voters replaced their two most conservative town council members with Democratic newcomers. Knott is betting that the petitions are not representative of the wider WCDP's feelings about him. He says he has the support of most of the party's area coordinators and executive committee members. On Tuesday, he sent the delegates to the upcoming county convention a 9-page letter explaining his reasoning for the Alam endorsement. It reads, in part, "I believe in a Democratic Party that welcomes debate and change, including in our primaries. A healthy party creates space for new leaders with new ideas to emerge, and it gives those leaders a fair fight in their primaries. Then, following that rigorous debate, accepts the primary results and moves forward in unity." In December, when Knott initially spoke to the Indy about his endorsement of Alam, he acknowledged there could be a downside. And he said, "I think the riskiest consequence of my decision to make a public endorsement is how future chairs leverage that power. I'm not trying to be a kingmaker or activist. When I ran for chair, I told people I was a progressive. I told them what my political views were. They have seen me in my first year continue what I did as executive director for the past few years, which is organize, educate, and mobilize voters to help elect Democrats. I'm focused on that work. But if I can take an hour of my time to stop by and support a progressive candidate in a really important district, I think that's a good investment, not just because it's what I believe personally, but I think it's a good investment of my time for the Democratic Party and for the people that I hear from every day that want a different direction." The two petitions calling for Knott's removal were sent to the NCDP's Council of Review, a special statewide committee. Per their plan of organization, the council will review the petitions, oversee a mediation process between Knott and the complainants, and then may decide to hold a hearing and vote on Knott's removal. The next article I'm reading directly from Indy Week Online, IndyWeek.com, where you can find yourselves all these articles and more besides, plenty more besides. I don't have time to read nearly half of what is published every week. "A Changing of the Guard in Wake Forest." And this is about Ben Clapsaddle. Last year, he unseated a 24-year incumbent to become the fast-changing conservative town's first Democratic mayor in decades. And that it was Wake Forest Mayor Vivian Jones, and he received over 70% of the vote. He ran on a platform of sustainable growth, fiscal responsibility, social inclusivity, and community engagement. Under state law, the mayoralty is largely symbolic, with the mayor all but limited to presiding over meetings, issuing proclamations, and casting the occasional tie-breaking vote. But there is one mayoral power the North Carolina General Assembly cannot take away: the bully pulpit. And Clapsaddle intends to use it. As his inaugural State of the Town address last month, he devoted particular concern to food insecurity and veterans' issues. Clapsaddle's victory marks a sea change in this town. His strongest precinct was 1909, which comprises the town's rapidly expanding eastern frontier. Oddly enough, this was the same part of town where Donald Trump performed best in 2024, but unlike Trump, Clapsaddle is a Democrat, the first in decades to lead Wake Forest. Despite the town's growing diversity and professed ideals, there is an abiding conservatism about the place. And this, by the way, is written by B.B. Miller. "Its elegant homes, its gnarled oaks, it is Wake Forest, after all, that birthed prominent segregationist I. Beverly Lake Sr. The Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, which maintains influence over town affairs, has inculcated leaders such as megachurch pastor Mark Harris, who now sits in Congress on a solidly MAGA basis. Ventilation tycoon and free market ideologue Robert Luddy lives in Wake Forest and operates several places of learning throughout the Triangle. The Human Rights Campaign calls one of his schools, Thales Academy, quote, horribly anti-LGBTQ, Daly's Wake Forest campus is situated in the Labyrinthine Club community, ominously named Heritage. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are personal for Ben Clapsaddle. He's the first person of color, his mother was Korean, to lead Wake Forest and may well even be the first Asian American mayor in state history. He grew up in a self-proclaimed half-breed kid in segregated Cumberland County. The local white school would not accept him and his sister, nor would the black school. The two were whisked off to the school for other races. This ordeal, in addition to moving frequently due to his father's military service, no doubt left young Clapsaddle with some sense of rootlessness. He joined the Army, which offered him a clear sense of direction. That driving need for belonging led Clapsaddle to Wake Forest in 2005. His first election bid was in 2011, when he came in sixth among a crowded field vying for a seat on the Wake Forest Board of Commissioners. His ambitions on hold, he focused on his children and his military career. There were few other military families in town, yet the Desert Storm veteran felt welcomed. He says Wake Forest, especially school teachers, reached out to help military kids. Whether his son, Nathan, who is gay, would also be welcomed was another matter. In June of 2024, Wake Forest was one of the last municipalities in Wake County to sign onto an interlocal non-discrimination agreement, nearly 3 years after its initial passage. Wake Forest's change of heart likely would not have been possible without the vote of Clapsaddle. One among many factors in his support was an act of vandalism that occurred weeks before his swearing-in as commissioner in 2023. A little free library dedicated to the LGBT community and built by a local Girl Scout troop was stolen. It had been ripped from its post. The next day, Clapsaddle visited the scene, quote, to personally apologize on behalf of the town. Tensions only mounted as Wake Forest prepared to host its first ever Pride Festival that October. The main street-friendly event was ultimately a success, with the somber protests of evangelicals all but ignored, but that changed last September. Facing mounting pressure from seminary leadership and the North Carolina Values Coalition, then Mayor Jones chose not to issue a proclamation recognizing LGBTQ History Month. In a redacted email obtained by citizen journalist Tom Baker, seminary executive Ryan Hutchison issued an apparent veiled threat to the town manager. The seminary controls hundreds of acres in town and has lent its weight to several development projects, including plans for a UNC health hospital. Such plans might have been jeopardized if the seminary's line in the sand was crossed. Jones reversed course later that same day. After first sidestepping that subject in an interview, Clapsaddle conceded, quote, I really believe that Mayor Jones tried to do what was the right thing, but I just wish she would have stuck with her guns. However, he does not believe the about-face role played a role in Jones's loss. He said, I think I ran a much better campaign. Clapsaddle was swept into office by the same anti-incumbent wave that overtook several Triangle suburbs and, indeed, the nation's largest city. But make no mistake, Clapsaddle is no Zoran Mamdani, although the two did both receive campaign contributions from supposed progressive billionaire Liz Simons. Clapsaddle, despite his blue-collar sensibilities, does not position himself as a disruptor, a la His Honor. On the contrary, he appears cautious, deferential, and even camera-shy, but he will fight when necessary. Evidenced by his office bookshelf, Clapsaddle is a student of one Lyndon Baines Johnson. Whereas the latter perfected the Johnson treatment, a means of persuasion characterized by emotional and physical smothering, the former opts for a folksier method he calls the fuss and cuss. In his 2 years on the Board of Commissioners, Clapsaddle distinguished himself as something of a maverick, perhaps in the mold of fellow serviceman John McCain. He demonstrated on a number of occasions his willingness to vote strategically. For example, in December of 24, he joined Conservative Commissioner Faith Cross in opposing a measure to move forward with the creation of a Wake Forest Social District. But unlike Cross, his opposition was not so much moral as technical. He alleged that some downtown establishments like Over the Falls and Norse Brewery, a favorite haunt, were initially left out of the scheme. He said, "I thought it was unfair." For reasons that are less clear, he also voted against a fee on developers that would fund needed infrastructure improvements. Clapsaddle's political maneuvering has not endeared him to everyone at Town Hall, though he certainly seems to be popular with the ladies at the front desk. But behind chamber doors, Clapsaddle readily admitted, "I can be the most arrogant, hard-headed person around." That said, there is a softer side to the man. His daughter, Rainey, was adopted from Guatemala. When deportations first ramped up under Obama administration, he said, "I insisted, because I was her father, that she carry all the proper IDs with her." Clapsaddle recalled that under former Sheriff Donnie Harrison, an immigration hardliner, there was, quote, "a lot of profiling of Hispanic residents in Wake County." Now, with the Supreme Court's approval, such tactics have only expanded in use. Rennie is a U.S. citizen, but that is no guarantee of her safety. Hundreds of citizens have been caught up in ICE raids, including one in Cary. Clapsaddle fears for his daughter, now grown and married. "I'm always afraid of the phone call from her husband saying, 'Did Rennie stop at your house?'" he said. The mayor has a message for federal agents: get a warrant. Amid the government's bloody occupation of Minneapolis, Clapsaddle appeals for calm and the rule of law. Quote, "I would ask that agents respect our schools, our churches, they respect our private homes and private businesses." Clapsaddle proudly draws attention to the fact that his mayoral campaign was almost entirely self-funded, albeit with no reported expenditures aside from a $500 penalty paid to the State Board of Elections by his son. Clapsaddle smiles a twinkle in his eyes. "We always sent our paperwork in late." His unsuccessful 2022 run for the Wake County Board of Education, however, drew considerably more attention from the donor class. Top contributors that cycle were Raleigh power couple Dean and Sisha Debnam, as well as Simons, the previously mentioned California kingmaker. Clapsaddle suspects it was the Debnams who put him on Simon's radar. Clapsaddle had come of age in Fayetteville, an army brat. He and his family lived in a trailer to which he ascribed a sensitivity to all walks of life. He expressed his regrets over former Wake Forest Mayor George Mackey's sale of a mobile home community in 2021, which displaced almost 50 families. He mused, "Is it right by the law, perhaps? Is it right by the people? And is it right for the future generations?" Boosters prefer to market Wake Forest as an affluent bedroom community, but the town's roots are inescapably working class. Manual labor, free or enslaved, built its cherished historic properties. One such property, the Royale Cotton Mill, was the site of a violent strike in 1951 that made national headlines. The mill closed in 1976 and took about 230 jobs with it. Today, heirs to the mill workers' legacy, cashiers, trash collectors, housekeepers, delivery drivers, still live in town. But it is becoming increasingly difficult for them to do so. Of course, Wake Forest's housing market predominantly serves an upwardly mobile, tech-savvy clientele. Disposable income, 1.9 kids, maybe a golden retriever. Poorer families, like those in Wellington Park, are being squeezed out. Cuts in SNAP and Medicaid funding have not helped. In the wake of these cuts, courtesy of Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, civil society stepped in. Clapsaddle marveled. It was amazing the amount of food donated. The tri-area ministry, the various churches, the various social groups that work hard to bring more food for people. The mayor is planning a food insecurity summit for August. The poorest part of Wake Forest, according to the American Community Survey, is a section of the traditionally black Northeast neighborhood, where the average per capita income sits at around $24,000. Clapsaddle conceded that gentrification is a growing problem. Reflecting on the significance of Black History Month, he added, I'm trying to honor not just what the Northeast community is today, but what it has been in the past. Starting in 2027, the town plans to make improvements to the local Ailey Young Park. Clapsaddle also plans to revive the town's Youth in Government Advisory Board, which commissioners abolished in 2020. He laments, right now, besides through some other community activities, we don't have a voice for our young people, our high school age kids. His campaign even hired a youth advisor with whom Clapsaddle shared his ideas for a spring future fest that would ensure the voices of Gen Z are not only heard but truly valued and celebrated. The mayor recalled a meaningful conversation he had with a stranger not too long ago who told Clapsaddle he was struggling with his identity. He vowed never to return to Wake Forest after high school, quote, because he doesn't feel he could live the life he wanted to there. In 2024, he came home for the inaugural Wake Forest Pride Festival. Brooks Street convulsed with color. Artisans peddled their wares, children squealed, and hands intertwined, all in full view of the town chapel's spire. Nathan Clapsaddle, taking a break from a dance with his fiancée, embraced his father. Dad, who would have ever thunk that Wake Forest, North Carolina would do this? Times have changed. Clapsaddle inherits a town in transition. The population almost quintupled between 2000 and 2025, out-of-staters fueling much of this growth. They brought with them their foreign godless ways, their Blackberries, their MBAs, their jazz CDs bought at Starbucks. Now multi-story apartment buildings and longleaf pines jostle for prominence. A cluster of old silos off State Route 98 bypass stands besieged by charming three beds. Traffic is getting worse. Wake Forest and countless places like it across the South is more diverse than ever before, and the good old days are, well, gone with the wind. In the Game of Thrones that is suburbia, the Realtors Association, the Chamber of Commerce, Rotary Club, the PTA, and the HOA all wield considerable power. But can the mayor match it? He declared, Clapsaddle like a Lincoln or Bush Sr. plays the long game, betraying a well-camouflaged ego, he declared. The mark I'll make on this town is something that's 10 years down the road, 15 years down, because that is what is important. Well, that's Wake Forest. And now over to Durham for this short article. Did detained Durham students with disabilities get the education they're owed? The state is investigating. After initially declining to act, North Carolina's Department of Public Instruction, DPI, has opened an investigation into whether Durham Public Schools, DPS, failed to educate disabled students detained at the Durham County Youth Home over the past year. That 36-bed juvenile detention facility on Broad Street houses young people awaiting the outcome of their cases in the juvenile legal system. The ACLU of North Carolina and Duke's Children's Law Clinic first filed a complaint with DPI in December, alleging when the youth home entered a lockdown last February, education essentially stopped. During the lockdown, which was triggered by a reported threat of physical harm, residents were confined to their cells nearly around the clock, according to the complaint. The facility contains three classrooms where DPS teachers normally provide up to 6 hours of daily instruction, but during the lockdown, students were pulled out for instruction at most 30 minutes a day, the complaints alleged. It focused on students with disabilities who make up a disproportionate share of youth in North Carolina's juvenile detention system and who, under federal law, must receive instruction tailored to their needs. Michelle Degado, a staff attorney at ACLU of North Carolina, told the Indy in this email, "These conditions are unsuitable for anyone, but students with disabilities are legally entitled to an individualized education plan, which would not be possible under the conditions that have been reported." Initially, this complaint filed in December was declined by DPI, saying it lacked sufficient evidence. But the ACLU and Children's Law Clinic refiled last month with new documentation, namely a report from Disability Rights NC, that's the state's federally designated disability advocacy organization, based on site visits to the youth home and interviews with some of the youth. The report found that instructional time at Durham's youth home had plummeted from 5 to 6 hours a day in 2024 to no more than an hour in 2025, and that youth were being confined to their cells for 22 to 24 hours a day. Even after the lockdown lifted in early 25, the report found conditions remained largely unchanged. This time, DPI has agreed to investigate, announcing on March 12th it would examine whether DPS met its special education obligations over a one-year period. The agency expects to issue a final report next month. If it finds the district to be out of compliance, DPI can order corrective measures. In a statement to India, a DPS spokesperson wrote that while the district provides up to 6 hours of daily instruction at the youth house, it doesn't control how much classroom time residents actually receive. And the spokesperson wrote this: "During the lockdowns, the youth home administration has significantly limited our teachers' access to students at the facility for safety reasons." Even outside of lockdowns, added DPS, the amount of classroom time students receive is determined by youth home administrators, and staffing shortages at the facility have sometimes limited teachers' access to students. As of January, the youth home had 45% vacancy rate among its counselor positions. Outside of the DPS statement, Durham County, which runs the youth home, did not separately comment on the ACLU's latest complaint and DPI's decision to investigate. The youth home previously pushed back on accounts of conditions inside the facility. In a January letter to Disability Rights NC, Youth Home Assistant Director Sheila Browns-Bratz wrote that claims of routine 22-plus hours of confinement don't accurately reflect how the facility operates. Bowens-Bratz wrote in that same letter that education in the facility is entirely DPS responsibility. The district staffs the classroom, manages the special ed services, and maintains students' educational records, she wrote, and the youth home has no authority over any of it. Delgado told Indy the ACLU hopes the investigation will improve conditions at the youth home and push DPI to better serve disabled students across the state's juvenile detention system. The organization has also called for North Carolina to ban solitary confinement of young people entirely, Delgado saying, "There's no question about the short and long-term psychological and physical harm that happens to youth whose brains will continue to develop well into their 20s when they are subjected to isolation." DPI has given DPS until March 27th to submit a written response to these allegations. Now, an article about public records and the production of them for inquiries. How did North Carolina towns do? I'll say this is quite a long article, and I may have to truncate it. in North Carolina. Nearly all documents that city and county government officials create or receive while carrying out their duties are considered the property of the people. State law requires officials to make those documents, including written communication like email, text, and social media posts, available, quote, as promptly as possible when anyone requests to inspect or copy them. Although the law is same across the state, the time it takes local officials who fulfill that requirement can look quite different across the state. Long delays and incomplete responses for communications records requests are common, frustrating the public's legal rights and the media's ability to hold leaders accountable. In conjunction with Sunshine Week, an annual celebration of open government and public records, NC Local, the Assembly, WFAE, and WUNC requested the same set of emails from North Carolina's 20 largest cities at the same time. Some provided the documents within minutes. Others placed the requests into queues that could take months or even years to clear. Chapter 132 of the General Statutes governs public records. And it goes on to all of these records in the form that they take in the archives. The law does exempt some documents, like communications covered by attorney-client privilege, sensitive security information, and negotiations over economic development incentive. But even if a document contains confidential information, government officials must still release the non-confidential portions and bear the cost of any redactions that they perform. Requesters don't have to share any reason for wanting to obtain these records, and they can request in any medium they'd like. Requests themselves are generally free. However, governments may charge for the actual cost of making copies, such as a flash drive for large files, or for the, quote, extensive use of information technology resources or extensive clerical or supervisory assistance. In practice, getting communications records from local governments can be a challenge. The law says officials must share records as promptly as possible. It doesn't define that phrase. Local governments generally don't establish any time frame for fulfilling records requests. Exceptions include the city of Greensboro, which says it aims to respond within 5 business days, and Guilford County, which sets a target of 10 business days for most routine requests. Mike Tadich, a lawyer who helps monitor the NC Press Association's legal hotline, said many jurisdictions take substantially longer to release records. Some requests in Charlotte, for example, have waited years for fulfillment. A 2024 analysis by the Charlotte Observer found more than 1,500 unfilled requests, including one ask for emails and text messages initially submitted in 2020. In other cases, officials don't share public records that requesters know exist. Pate McMichael, a communications instructor at Elon University and director of the NC Open Government Coalition, said elected officials often omit communications from their private cell phones and email accounts. The law considers those to be public records if they were sent or received regarding official business, but government staffers have no way to verify if a city council member, for example, is turning over all relevant messages from his or her personal phone number or Facebook page. McMichael says unless you're willing to sue, it's very difficult to get them to disclose. I just don't feel confident that even if you get back what it is they're turning over, you're getting the full story. Time for a test. So NC Local and its media partners asked 22 cities for the same set of records, all emails sent to or from the city's clerk between 9 a.m. and noon on February 24th. Journalists with these media outlets used identical language and sent all records requests on the morning of February the 27th. So I guess that was 3 days after these whatever messages were sent back and forth from the city clerk. Each request was submitted to the city's formal public records portals. If a city didn't have a portal, The request went by email to a public information officer or directly to the city clerk. The experiment covered North Carolina's 20th largest cities by population, from Charlotte through Wake Forest. The Border Belt Independent, part of the Assembly Network, also submitted requests to Lumberton and Pembroke. Which cities provided documents? So this was 3 days after the date requested. More than 2 weeks after these inquiries went out, fewer than half the cities had provided the requested mails. The quickest to respond was Chapel Hill, which shared its documents in less than 30 minutes. Apex, in just over an hour, and Huntersville also responded on the same day. Burlington, High Point, and Kannapolis all responded within a week. Durham provided records on March 9th, Fayetteville on the 11th, and Charlotte on March 12th. Pembroke's clerk responded on the 12th, saying she had neither sent nor received any emails during that time period. The formats of the responses varied. Some cities shared each email as a separate PDF document. Kannapolis combined everything into a single 52-page PDF, and other cities provided the records as Microsoft Outlook files, which require specialized software to open. The emails themselves provided a glimpse into the workaday business of city administration and the variety of jobs city clerks are tasked with accomplishing. Durham clerk Diana Schreiber, for example, spent the morning of the 24th asking for updates on city committees, coordinating response to records requests, and approving a purchase order for chai latte K-cups. Now, this article, which I'm not part of, has a graph, and I will summarize that graph. It's very brief. It just tells the lag time, and then I won't have to read the entire rest of the article. February 27th, requests were submitted. Apex, Chapel Hill, and Huntersville came back the same day. About 1 week later, March 3rd, Burlington, and then High Point, Kannapolis. March 9, Durham. March 11, Fayetteville. Pembroke and Charlotte on the 12th. Greensboro on the 16th. So this is the 16th to the 27th. And March the 17th, which is 20 days after. Request unfulfilled still by then. Winston-Salem, Wilmington, Greenville, Asheville, Wake Forest, Jacksonville, Lumberton, Concord, Gastonia, and Raleigh, and Cary. Most cities that hadn't provided records after 2 weeks gave no communication about the requests other than automated response. Other cities had staff acknowledge the receipt. Despite the clear lack of consistency behind how local governments handle these requests, there are currently no efforts at the General Assembly to refine or tighten the relevant law. Senator Greg Mayer, a Democrat from Chapel Hill, who received the 2024, quote, Sunshine Award for Public Service from the Open Government Coalition, said colleagues on both sides of the aisle have been reluctant to support that work. Mayer recently announced his resignation from public office effective at the end of this month so he could serve as executive director of the North Carolina Justice Center. He said, I wish all politicians believed that transparency actually made us more effective at our jobs. The truth is, they don't. Sometimes, including in the General Assembly, that's because people are hiding their corruption, Meyer said. Sometimes it's just because people are hiding their fear. And sometimes there are people who just don't want to have to articulate what it is they stand for and why, which should be a basic requirement for people to hold public office. And while the core of the records law has remained in place, the legislature has added meaningful exceptions in recent years. McMichael with Open Government Coalition pointed to a provision in the state's 2023 budget that allows General Assembly members to deny any request for their own records. Last year, the state also exempted name, image, and likeness contracts for college athletes, thereby shielding millions of dollars in taxpayer spending on athletics from public scrutiny. In contrast, recent bills that would have expanded public records access have died in committee. These efforts included the Government Transparency Act, the HALL Accountability Act, and a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the public's right to access records. And last part of this, how to speed up records requests. Any member of the public can ask for any public document. If you're requesting communications or other public records from your local government, lawyer Mike Tadich says there are some best practices you can employ to reduce the turnaround time. Be as specific as possible when asking for communications between city council members. Try narrowing the scope to a limited time frame or asking only for emails that contain a certain keyword. If you do need a large volume of records, break up your request into several smaller inquiries. That can give officials more flexibility in providing records over time. Ask for serial production, S-E-R-I-A-L. In other words, have officials provide individual records as they are received and cleared for release, rather than waiting for the entirety of a request to be processed. And then consider making requests in person. State law allows for the inspection of records, quote, at reasonable times and under reasonable supervision. This approach can help avoid administrative fees for making copies of large records requests. More resources for making public records requests are available through the North Carolina Open Government Coalition's website. Pate McMichael, the coalition director, encourages anyone having issues with a records request to reach out through that organization's contact form or call its hotline at this phone number, 336-278-5506. 336-278-5506. Okay, let's get to some music, because coming right up this weekend, the Carrboro Django Reinhardt Festival returns for its fifth edition. Acoustic jazz, communal jam sessions, and a rare slice of European music culture to local venues. It was founded in 2016 by local musicians Gabriel Pelli. The festival survived pandemic hiatus and lost years of lost momentum before springing back to life last year, when every concert and workshop sold out and the Sunday jam ran for 7 straight hours, writes Russ Campbell. For Pelli, staging the festival is a side gig, albeit a consuming one, and he says, it's basically a one-man show. I'm the founder, director, creative director. I do get help along the way, for sure, but I didn't revive it till last year. I just ran out of steam. Running even a modest festival is no small task. Booking artists, coordinating international flights, signing contracts, managing ticketing platforms, handling marketing, scheduling workshops, negotiating venue splits, and balancing guest lists against a tight budget. Pelli does it between rehearsals, teaching, and the rest of his life. Growing up, Pelli did not play this kind of music. He didn't even know it existed. He said, it all started with a friend of mine, Wells Gordon. He wanted to put together a hot club-style band and needed a violinist, any warm body that could play violin. At the time, he played only classical violin and had yet to hear of Django Reinhardt. Gordon sent him recordings. Pelli says, I loved it right away. He told me I could just sight-read the melodies. I'd play the melody at the beginning of the tune. The guitarist would take the solos. Then I'd come back at the end, and that's how I started. From there, curiosity turned into obsession. He began experimenting with improvisation on violin, then later picked up guitar to better understand the language of the style. What started as filling a seat in the band slowly reshaped his musical life. The festival itself came nearly a decade into that journey. The first edition was sparked by a French guitarist named Stéphane Rembel, who grew up near the town where Django Reinhardt had lived. When Pelli saw he was touring nearby, he reached out cold. He said, I just wanted him to come here so I could hear him. I told him I'd set up the show and promote it. Rembel agreed, but suggested they call it the Django Reinhardt Festival and add a workshop. That first year was straightforward. One afternoon workshop and an evening concert. The festival is devoted to Reinhardt. That's the Belgian-born Romani guitarist who reshaped jazz in the 1930s with a radically inventive approach. Born into a traveling Romani family that moved throughout Western Europe, Reinhardt eventually settled on the outskirts of Paris. After a caravan fire severely damaged his left hand, doctors recommended amputation. He refused. With limited use of two fingers, he rebuilt his technique. Pelle describes Reinhardt's approach. He had these two fingers for lead melodies, and the others mainly for chords. When you try to play one of his licks, you realize it actually works best with two fingers, because that's how he had to do it. Often labeled gypsy jazz, also known as jazz manouche, Sinti jazz, hot club jazz, or Django-style jazz, the musical style blends American swing with European waltzes and Romani traditions. While the terminology carries cultural nuance, you bet it does, the style has endured most vibrantly within Western European Sinti, S-I-N-T-I, communities, where it functions as living folk music, learned young, and passed down socially across generations. Pelle said, referring to communities in the Netherlands, Germany, and France, it's really become their folk music. There's no better way to get really good than to be surrounded by other good players and to play all the time. The communal ethic anchors that Carborough Festival. Alongside ticketed concerts and workshops, Sunday's free jam session at Le Pain Bleu in Chapel Hill serves as the weekend's gravitational center. Musicians rotate in and out. At one point at a past festival, Pelle found himself trading choruses with Reinhardt's great-grandson. It was surreal, he said. You realize you're inside a lineage. This year's lineup leans into that living tradition. The Dutch guitarist Paulus Schaefer highlights the weekend, traveling from the Netherlands for two nights at Kratz Cradle Back Room. Schaefer grew up immersed in the Sinti jazz scene and is widely regarded as one of the leading contemporary voices in the style. And he's joined by the Baltimore guitarist Sam Farthing, 24 years of age, whose playing has drawn high praise from aficionados. Pelle says he plays like he grew up in a Sinti camp in Holland, which is about the highest compliment you can give. Now, concerts run Friday and Saturday nights. You'll hear this broadcast on Friday, the 20th, and on Saturday night, the 21st. Daytime workshops are focused on rhythm technique, improvisation, and ensemble interplay. And the jam on Sunday, March 22nd, is free and informal. No ticket required. Pelle says even if you can't afford a workshop or a concert, you can come by for free and listen to the jam. Anybody can participate in the festival in some way. Carborough is not an obvious stop for European touring musicians. Most cluster in New York, Chicago, or the Bay Area. That this music lands here at all is a testament to Pelle's persistence. And he says Django started something almost 100 years ago. Every time we play it together, we're keeping that conversation alive. For a few nights in March, Carborough joins that conversation. My printed copy of this article does not include websites. I'm sure there are some, and just a simple search in Google for the Django Reinhardt Festival in Carborough will tell you what you need to know. Some, like you know already, the lessons and the concerts are ticketed, or at least admission is charged, but the jam session is not. I'm down to about 2 minutes now, and I'll get you to another festival, also happening in Carborough, Chapel Hill, and Durham, and it's called the Big Pop Show. It's Friday, the 20th, through Monday, March the 23rd, and the cost can vary depending on what you go to, $15 to $40, various venues. A music festival can be a beautiful thing, but it can also be a machine that launders vast quantity of money through young talent into old pockets. The Big Pop Show, coming to the Cat's Cradle Back Room, the Arts Center, Duke Coffee House, and the Pinhook for 4 days, starting Friday the 20th, dispenses with that power differential. Instead of commercial sponsors, support comes from Duke Coffee House and Duke's and UNC's student radio stations, WXDU and WXYC, where the five organizers have all been involved in various ways. Three of them live in the Triangle. The other two are in Chicago, and they're all in their early 20s, the same age as the dozens of bands they're convening from around the South, the Midwest, and beyond. The festival is volunteer-run. All the proceeds go to the bands. Rather than navigating booking agencies, they reached out directly to artists they know or admire. There's no hierarchy, no fight for type size on a flyer, just a small, beautiful subsection of do-it-yourself music culture today. According to one of the organizers, whose psych rock band TV Buddha will also perform. Though guitars will be plentiful, Big Pop offers an array of genres. The common thread is a drive for independence in community to create something local, tangible, and real, said Nathan McMurray, a Durham native whose new band Sects, S-E-C-T-S, sounds like early Modest Mouse. Big Pop debuted last year with a one-day event at Duke Coffee House, emerging organically from the friendships of the organizers. With a bigger footprint now, accessibility remains a priority. Last year's small-scale fest was free. This one much more ambitious, $15 a night or $40 for all 4 days. Still a relative bargain, I can tell you. So, Big John has to close this article and the issue of Indie Week at this time, reminding you that it will be a podcast after you first hear it on Friday the 20th. And North Carolina Reading Service.org brought you this program and will bring you every week a new edition of The Independent Indie Week. And right now, for reading that journal, I'm John Fetterson, who's hitting the road, and I'll be back next week with the next issue. So long, everybody.